Hello, everyone, and welcome. Welcome to the Power of Privilege and Allyship podcast. My name is Funke Abimbola, and I'm the CEO and founder of the Austin Bronte Consultancy. The consultancy's main goal is to improve leadership by leveraging the impact of diversity, inclusion, belonging, and equity across the business world. Thanks to you, our lovely listeners, our podcast has become a huge success since our April launch, with almost 2,000 downloads, listeners in 38 countries, 289 cities across all continents, and over 30 published episodes. We've also been ranked as a top podcast for careers by Apple Podcasts, so please continue to share, like, rate, subscribe, and comment on Apple Podcasts so that we can reach an even bigger audience than we have before. Today, I am so excited to be speaking to Habib, who happens to be one of our Akindolia Medical Scholars. Habib, welcome. A warm welcome to our podcast.
Hi, Dr. Funke. Thank you for inviting me onto the podcast.
It's wonderful to have you, Habib. And obviously, I know a lot about you already because I reviewed your application last year and I was very, very impressed by what you'd achieved and your goals for the future. But our wider audience may not be so familiar with you, Habib. So do you mind introducing yourself to our audience and telling us all a bit more about you?
Okay. My name is Habib Kamal. I'm currently, I'm about to go into my fifth year of medical school at Nottingham. And I'm basically a medical student, but I've done a lot of other things at the side throughout medical school and a bit before, but I'll focus on medical school now because that's sort of my career. I think in my first year of medical school, I was very involved in sort of widening participation. Came from a state school background, so you can imagine for a career like medicine, widening participation is very, very important just to ensure that obviously the doctors of tomorrow are reflective of the communities that they serve. And that sort of opened my eyes into a lot of things regarding sort of what is really important for people when they aspire to do medicine and the sort of support and sort of access that they need. And I did that work for about a year and a bit, working with the university to develop sort of sessions and resources just to help those students that may come from schools that don't really prepare them as much as other schools. And moving on from that, in my second year, I was basketball captain. It's not exactly an academic thing, but...
Congratulations.
Yeah. So I think we played quite a few varsities and games around the university. We won some competitions. And that was really good for me because obviously I think when you're in medicine, you can get so bogged down with trying to get your publications, trying to obviously pass your exams. For a lot of people, they don't really try to spend time to, I guess, just focus on your hobbies. Knowing how to rest is just as important as knowing how to work hard. So I think second year was probably what I would call my rest year. That summer in my second year, I did my first research project, basically looking at the differential gene expression of the cystic fibrosis protein. Basically, I met this academic pediatrician, probably one of the smartest guys I've met, and he realized that for a lot of children that he treated with antibiotics, the ones that had cystic fibrosis seemed to do better on certain antibiotics than others, because some antibiotics are known to be nephrotoxic, so they can be dangerous to the kidney. And he wanted to know whether it was because of the specific mutations that they had in the gene that causes cystic fibrosis that protected them from these nephrotoxic antibiotics. So I spent my summer reading genetic codes of the cystic fibrosis protein, trying to match them up across different types of mutations and then matching them up across different kidney genes to see which mutations actually were expressed differently in the kidney. And I found about 5 specific cystic fibrosis mutations that were differentially expressed in the kidney. And I presented that at a few medical research conferences the year after that. So that was sort of my second year. In my third year, I started this. We would say social impact organization, but it was also a university society. So it was called One Heritage. It was pretty much focused on increasing awareness of sort of contemporary events and in particular sort of African history. It became important to me. I'm not sure. I think the summer before there was just a lot of stuff going on in the news, and I found it was hard to sort of process and to discuss, and I felt like a lot of people were feeling the exact same way. So I got a couple of friends We created a few sort of events based around debates, some based around music and talent shows. And it was quite nice. I think it, more than anything, allowed me to meet a lot of different people, but also understand how the world works and improve sort of my people skills. So I guess that was probably another year of rest, if you don't count the sort of research project I mentioned before. Also, my third year, I did a presentation with the BMA. So I got really into digital health, and the opportunity came to sort of submit a motion to the British Medical Association. So they basically lobby with many different bodies, such as the government and medical schools, to try and get policies in that sort of reflect the views of the medical profession and medical students. So at that time, I was trying to get digital health education into medical schools. It was very, very interesting, very, very scary, obviously, speaking at the British Medical Association. There's a video of it on the internet, if you can find it.
Oh, wow, I'm going to check that out after this. My goodness, yeah. That sounds fascinating.
Yeah, I'm not sure if you can see the fear in my face as I'm speaking. But but that also helped me to understand how policy works, how lobbying works, and how sort of, I guess, legislation is made and decisions are made. And I met a lot of people in that sort of that side of medicine during that time. Also that year, I applied to the Clinical Entrepreneur Program, became one of the youngest to become a clinical entrepreneur. I started MedTech UON, which is basically a medical technology society in Nottingham. So it was the first one. And we were sort of focused on sort of taking what I had seen and what I had learned from the BMA and from my research, and try to create a sort of space and environment where medical students can get involved with innovation in medicine. Because I guess the medical course can get pretty jam-packed, basically, and it's quite hard for them to add new things to it. So new and innovative things rarely ever, you rarely ever see as an undergraduate. It's sort of the sort of things you find out when you're much older. So we're just trying to bring that to sort of our level. After that, I decided I wanted to do a master's, which was in epidemiological modelling, looking at sort of outcomes in heart failure and how we can, I guess, predict them. And then I also got picked by the Dean of Medical Education to go on a summer camp. So it was an international summer camp. I'm supposed to actually spend the summer, last summer, in Italy, but it didn't happen because of COVID. I think they were one of the first countries to be really hit badly. So it ended up being online, but it was still good because I met a lot of people across the world, actually. Canadians, students from Chinese University of Hong Kong, students from all over Europe. It was basically like a month and a half, and they basically taught us the Stanford course on artificial intelligence in medicine. So we learned all these things about computer vision, machine learning. We learned a lot in those 5 weeks, and I managed to win a competition, actually. With my team, we created a machine learning model which predicted pneumonia from X-ray images, which was very, very obviously topical in case of COVID, which is what everybody was getting when they got COVID. To be honest, I want to move forward with that and take that forward, but obviously with exams and medicine, there's only so much you can do at once. And so that was last summer, and this summer with the COVID pandemic and my fourth year of medicine, I just decided to just focus on my studies. I didn't do much other than read up on a few things, and yeah, so that's sort of me so far, my story so far over the last 5 years.
My goodness, it's just that mind-blowing, the variety, the depth, the breadth, you know, of the different topics, and the way that medtech is so important. I just keep seeing, you know, digitization, and that's very, very important. And my son is a future software engineer, so very aware of all the, you know, coding and the limitless possibilities for that in all industries, really. You know, not just in medicine. But why did you choose medicine at all, Habib? What was it about medicine that was an obvious choice for you?
I think so. In my AS levels, I took biology, chemistry, physics, and maths and further maths. And I was like, I was doing all of this sort of science and maths, and I was like, wow, I could really do anything. I could go from engineering to biology to chemistry, and every single thing sort of interested me. And what I sort of realized with medicine was that, okay, there is this very, very heavy scientific part to it, but there's this very, very human and caring part to it as well. And I think that's what sort of grabbed me, because I'm a people, I think innately I'm just a people's person. So I enjoy talking to people, learning about people, having that personal connection to people, and having to being able to marry that up with science, I think works best. And I think it's a bit personal, but it's also like a, I guess, a religious thing to it. So I'm Muslim, and I think one of the like in Islamic law, one of these obligations that you have is that when you work and when you earn money, it has to be in a way that doesn't sort of exploit people. You can't really exploit people in the NHS. So it's one of the things that that grabbed me, because I felt like, okay, I can spend my life at least caring for people in that way, so I can obviously pass those obligations that I would have.
No, that's fantastic. It's always wonderful to hear that faith can have an impact as well.
Yeah.
Although my line of my family is Christian, most of my cousins are Muslim on my dad's.
Really?
Yes,
oh,
yes,
wow.
Yes. Okay. So my grandfather was the rebel who converted and decided to become a Christian. But most of my cousins on my dad's side of the family are Muslim.
That's quite
so,
interesting.
So, you know,
actually,
we celebrate both and the families.
Oh, okay. I think a lot of Nigerian families are like that. So I have an aunt that we visit. She's also a Christian. And we celebrate Christmas, we celebrate Eid, and we just give each other food and presents. So, yeah.
No, it's fantastic. But it's just great to hear that your faith actually has been an element of your choice in your career. Mm, you know, it's always nice, because, you know, obviously faith does mean a lot to me as well.
Yeah.
But so I'm really intrigued, Habib, because you do so many different things. And I'm always fascinated to know how you structure your day. How do you manage to prioritize and plan? Give us a sense of that.
I think so. At the time when I was most busy, especially, I think third year, that was when I first realized that I can't just sort of take it as I go along. So I sort of tried to use my phone calendar application a lot. So I just put everything in there. If it's not in the calendar, it just doesn't exist to me, because otherwise I wouldn't be able to balance the obligations. And it's good. Like, I think it's a case of, I think it's first things first, right? One of the best pieces of advice that I got given, it was given by my supervisor in the research project I did in second year that I mentioned earlier, is that take every opportunity that doesn't affect your other opportunities.
Sure.
So it's like, be a yes man, unless saying yes impedes you to other future. And I think that's just been the best thing, because I think, especially as a young person, you have like huge capacity to learn and to develop. And a lot of people put things away saying, I'll do it later and do it later. But I think once you get to a certain age, once you become an adult, you actually have responsibilities which you don't have as a young person. And I think that's just been the most important thing for me. So I say yes a lot to a lot of things, and I just try to put them in my calendar as soon as I can. And as I said earlier before, making sure you know how to rest as well, because good work isn't really about how long you can work, but how focused and how the quality of your work, I guess. I'm sure you've heard of the phrase deep work.
Oh, yes.
So shallow work doesn't really do much, but deep work is when you actually do the most effective things.
Yeah, no, that's really, really important. And just, you know, talking about my son again, prioritizing and planning is something that he's had to really, really work very hard on. His preferred style is to just sort of go with it, kind of thing, which doesn't work very well when they're conflicting obligations. So I'm always intrigued to hear how people structure their day. And you know, is there any such thing as a typical day for you, for example, Habib?
I think it changes every year, actually. So my typical day this year, with being on placement, would be I'd wake up, obviously do what you have to do when you wake up, and then straight away go to the hospital, take the bus or whatever, and you go to the ward round. So the ward round will start very, very early, up till midday, depending on the department that you're in. And then as a result, you're basically seeing every single patient in the ward round, taking histories, doing examinations, looking at the investigations, and then making a management plan. And then as a medical student, you're normally left with writing all of that up. And then so that happens until midday. Then after midday, you have lunch. And after lunch, you do sort of the job. So that's when they've said, okay, do bloods, that's when you do the bloods. When they say chase up bloods, that's when you chase up bloods. When it says go get the x-rays and all these other things, so that's when you do all of the plans that were made in the morning. But it differs depending on the department you're in. And then normally you might get a break, maybe you have an afternoon off, then you can go to the library to revise your exams, which never end, as I'm told. And after that, you go home, and then you don't really go home. It's not like back in secondary school where you'd go home and you can and play on the Xbox or whatever. You go home to the library again to cover what you might have missed because you have exams at the end of the year. That's what I would call the normal day.
Gosh, that gives me a really clear picture, actually. Very, very vivid, you know.
Yeah.
Especially that sort of the role of the medical student in writing up the notes. Oh, yeah. That's something I hear.
Yeah.
I hear that a lot.
Yeah, it doesn't change when you're a junior doctor either. Like, it's just a lot of paperwork.
Yeah, but it's important to keep those records, isn't it, really? Yeah,
definitely, definitely. And illegal records as well. So you have to make sure you do them to quite a good standard. And I think, obviously, as a junior, there isn't much that you... Like, you might think you know a lot, but obviously, compared to your seniors, you don't know as much. So it's just for you to just watch and learn, I guess, to a point where you can actually start making those decisions yourself and all those other things. But yeah.
Oh, it's just fantastic, honestly. So, I mean, these podcast discussions always sort of home in very quickly on the meaning of privilege, you know, allyship, why diversity and inclusion is important. So I'll start with privilege. What is your understanding of privilege, Habib?
I think privilege is any sort of advantage, whether earned or unearned. So as I said before, I'm quite into innovation and entrepreneurship and medical research. So you can imagine for a lot of people, they might not understand how medical research works, as I didn't before I was an intern. I did my research internship, and I guess my supervisor had that privilege of that knowledge and shared it with me. At the same time, as I got onto the entrepreneur program, I started understanding that a lot of people don't actually understand entrepreneurship either. So things like how to build good businesses, and employees, where to find investors, turning your intellectual capital, your intellectual property into a marketable business. All of these things that I sort of have, I want to say gatekeeped, but they're just not things that you're taught at school generally. It's not something that you have a conversation about in your household dining table, unless you come from a specific kind of family. So I think there's a lot of things like that, a lot of pieces of knowledge like that, that isn't available to everyone. And it's a privilege for you to have it, if you haven't had to pay or do anything for it. So I guess that is what privilege is and how I understand it.
Yeah, no, that's a really good way of putting it, actually. And I suppose, you know, with allyship then, first of all, what would you say allyship means to you? And do you think there's a relationship between that and privilege?
So allyship is when you share that privilege, as I understand it. So even, let's say, for example, something similar to something really simple as, okay, I've got really good notes on this topic on my course and my friend doesn't have good profit, I'll be an ally to him and share with him. But also, as I said before, in my sort of widening participation work, I'm trying to be an ally to those students from backgrounds who might not have access to medical course. You have to be an ally and share that information with them. And it's just collaboration. I think that's how I describe it. Any form of collaboration is allyship, especially when you recognize that somebody doesn't have the privilege that you have.
No, that's a really good way of putting it. No, I love that. And we talk a lot about diversity and inclusion, and sometimes in a good way, you know, sometimes frankly in a bad way. I think there's been in some parts of society and the business world and other organizations, there's a bit of a backlash around diversity and inclusion. What were your thoughts on that?
To be honest, I think a lot of people, it might be a misunderstanding on what the goals of diversity and inclusion is. Let's say, for example, so I've told you about my work in cystic fibrosis, right? A couple of decades ago, it used to be the most common genetic condition in the UK, but it was included within sort of medical research, and the researchers really got to work. They produced, they did the research to find the genes that cause cystic fibrosis, did the research to create the genetic therapies that can sort of help patients with cystic fibrosis just be able to get the right. So when you have cystic fibrosis, you have sort of a 4T gene for a protein in your cell. So they found genetic therapies to help repair that 4T gene. And now, for many cystic fibrosis patients, when it used to be a condition where people would pass away at early age, they can live to about mid-age. And that's increasing year on year as a result of the research that's happened. And that's a result of diversity and inclusion, because it's a rare disease. Not everybody has it, but they decided to invest in that sort of thing. They decided to invest in that condition. Now, if we look at something similar, a similar genetic condition, which is now the most common genetic condition in the UK, sorry, sickle cell disease.
Yes.
So it's not the most common condition in the UK. But unfortunately, currently, there isn't the same amount of, I guess, investment in coming towards a cure. Well, there are a lot of clinical trials happening currently, but the majority of them are in sort of the US. And because they also have a heavy population burden as the UK, when I talk about things such as diversity and inclusion, especially in terms of medical research and innovation entrepreneurship, I think if we look at what we've done with cystic fibrosis and if we can do that with sickle cell disease, that would be a good example of diversity and inclusion, making sure that these rare, well, let's not say rare, because as I said before, it's the most common condition, genetic disorder in the UK, but these conditions which may not have the same amount of, I guess, the same amount as people that have, let's say, diabetes or high blood pressure, which are more common medical conditions, we still have to find a way to invest as much as possible in terms of medical research into developing therapies that work for these conditions, to include them in our research, include them in how we see medicine. So as I said before, for cystic fibrosis patients nowadays, you can actually get inhalers that can help sort of your lungs or the cells in your lungs function properly. Now, if we can find some sort of gene therapy that can do that for patients with sickle cell disorder, I think that would be a great win. And that's just a little example of a way that I can talk about cystic fibrosis in sort of the field that I'm in and what I'm working on. And obviously there's other steps to it as well. It's not just a case of investing in medical research. When it comes to creating medicines, as you must know, you do work in pharmaceuticals.
I do, yes.
Clinical trials, getting those efficacy. And then after that is then finding investors to take that research, clinical research, into actually a product, and then making sure that product is ready for market, and then creating, I don't know, IP policy that can incentivize more entrepreneurs to create more products, to create a diversity of options for the consumers, and then, I don't know, lobbying the NHS to buy those medicines. So obviously there's a huge ecosystem to it. But when we talk about diversity and inclusion, a lot of people always talk about, obviously, when it comes to equality with gender and race and things like that, it's also very, very real in the medical world as well. When we look at conditions that affect subsections of the population that might be overlooked before. So I think that's my own niche sort of outlook and into sickle cell disease as an example of diversity and inclusion.
There's so many layers to it in medicine, aren't there, as you say, yeah. Habib, because, you know, it's I'm very familiar with the clinical trial process because of my decade-long, that's my second career within pharmaceutical industry. And, you know, having diversity with clinical trial recruitment is a huge challenge for some disease areas and for all sorts of reasons. But there's so many other layers to why diversity is a good thing. Within medicine itself. And I just wondered how you feel about things like decolonizing the curriculum is something I hear a lot spoken about.
There's a lot to be said about decolonizing all curricula, I guess. Obviously, we've all grown up in a very, very, a corpus of knowledge that has come from, I guess, just one side of the world, one tradition, if you may. And that one tradition gives us a sort of worldview that's very, very singular. And I guess when people talk about decolonizing the curriculum, and it's about recognizing that huge bias towards one tradition and making sure we have a more equal understanding of the world around us. So I think specifically in the medical field, you must be aware of the history of many, many medical specialties, how they started, particularly in America. The obstetrics and gynecology field, for example, started through doing a lot of examinations on Black women without much, I guess, consent. But equally at the same time, there are sort of instances where, let's say, for example, all discoveries that we're taught are discoveries by sort of America and Europe, whereas obviously their traditional systems and traditional communities, you may have come to those discoveries before. And so when we talk about sort of decolonizing the curriculums, being able to understand that knowledge comes from everywhere and it doesn't come from just one place. I think I read a research paper recently that said when explorers first came to Somalia, the nomads that were living in that region were trying to tell the explorers that the mosquitoes, they hold malaria, or what they called malaria at the time, and they were just sort of ignored. And then 100 years later, somebody else discovers malaria, and that's what's written in the sort of history book. So I guess understanding how diverse knowledge can come from different places, and understanding not just the quality, but the value of that knowledge, I guess, and putting that in the right context, in the right place. So I think, for example, I think I mentioned IP earlier when I was talking about sort of a possible therapy for sickle cell anemia. For a lot of intellectual property, the knowledge of being able to take your intellectual property and being able to make it into something that actually brings money or value back to you is something that only certain people know. So if we say I am a scientist in a third world country and I have found a brand new antibiotic based on, I don't know, a family recipe, right? In order for me to make money from the work that I've done to find an antibiotic, I'll take it to a large pharmaceutical corporation who will then take a cut to get the IP protection to make it into a drug, and then I don't really get a return on that. I think that a lot of it, it's a bit like the COVID vaccine. So I think a lot of people talk about how the COVID vaccine was developed on public funds, but the IP is currently sort of just owned by the companies who produce it. So, and it's not free. And now you see all of these things of countries having to pay money for a vaccine that was publicly funded and not having the means or the industry to produce it themselves. And then you find, obviously, the citizens of these countries not being in a very good position to protect themselves from a disease that's affecting everyone simply because they were born in the wrong place or they just lived in the wrong place. And it's, I guess, for certain things like if we're talking about like trademarks, I don't know, Nike Jordans, for example. Okay, you created that, you have the, it's a shoe, right? But when we're talking about medicine, it's not really the same thing. There's obviously a huge debate to be had regarding sort of, I guess, the ethics of intellectual property when it comes to medicine and the ethics of actually selling medicine and having to balance with people's lives. Especially when it's critical. That's just something that I've been reading about recently. It does hit very hard because I know a lot of family and friends that don't live in the West, that don't live in America or Europe, that to get access to the COVID vaccine becomes as a result of if their government can negotiate with donations to get it from the countries that do have these industries and these pharmaceuticals. So that is probably my answer to that.
Yeah, there's so many implications with health inequity when you look at the world as a whole. And I suppose where I would come from on that is having worked in the pharmaceutical industry and looking at the R&D spend and even the model is not a terribly efficient one, really. Mm-hmm. And, you know, we're always trying to find ways of making the clinical trial process itself more efficient because it's so costly, you know. But yeah, in some way, that cost needs to be recouped in some way. Yeah. So playing devil's advocate a bit there, it can't, you know, it can rarely be at cost. Because the model doesn't work that way.
It isn't an easy job to create the vaccines, especially at the efficacy levels that they have done. And it must have cost a lot of money, employment and production and all that stuff. It'll take me some time to actually think about having that. That's a very good rebuttal. Yeah.
So what's next for you, Habib? You know, obviously you'll be going into your final year very soon. And what are your plans after that? Do you have any idea what you want to do in the future?
Personally, I am very, very interested in academic medicine, you might have realised, and research. So that's where I'd like to do. I'd like to become a sort of clinical academic. And I think that's just the first thing, trying to graduate, become a doctor, see how things are, then I don't really know specifics currently, simply because you don't know the future. But anything I can do to just help improve lives, save lives, and improve just sort of the quality of life and the standard of life, I guess, for everyone involved, and do my bit to teach the next generation moving forward. I don't know. It sounds a bit vague, but that's sort of the stage I'm at in life where there's so many of these, pathways that I could take on a professional level, and I don't really know what differentiates between them. Yeah, I need some sort of real life experience. And what a lot of my my friends in the that I've already graduated tell me is that even the job, like being a doctor, is nothing compared to medicine. You sort of learn on the job anyway. I'm looking forward to learning on the job and seeing what I can do to make a difference, really.
It sounds so exciting because I don't imagine this will be limited to the UK for you at all. Being a global citizen or continuing that. What are your thoughts on that, traveling and...
I think... Being a global citizen, well, that's the thing. I don't have much experience outside of the UK. Like, I've lived here all my life, except for a few family holidays, visiting family here and there. So I think it's a case of, I think the first step is my elective. So depending on how COVID goes, like what's on the green list, what's on the red list and whatever, I'll try to go somewhere outside of the country and see what life is like on a from a medical point of view, not as a holiday goer. But actually see how hospitals work and healthcare systems work as well, and see if I have sort of a role to play and something I can sort of help with in that thing. But yeah, I'm definitely, my eyes are wide open to the big wide world, and I like to see what I can from what I know. That's it, really.
Oh, it sounds wonderful, honestly. Our time's not at all. I mean, our time is almost up, but I just wondered if there's anything that you'd like to have said during our conversation, Habib, that you've not had a chance to say so far?
The challenges that I may have overcome.
Would you mind just sharing a bit more about that, actually? If there are any particular challenges that you had to overcome and how you overcame them?
I think there's been quite a few. And I think it's just part of going through university and as it goes, just adapting to medical school. The medical school is not a normal environment in the sense that you're surrounded by a lot of really intelligent people, really competitive people. And it's obviously a space where you're taught how to care for people as well. So adapting to that from obviously just living at home normally is obviously a challenge. Then there's leadership. So from what I've said before, I started about two societies in my time at uni. And at first, when you sort of think of the idea with your friends, yeah, let's start a society, let's do this, you think it's fun. And then when it comes to actually meeting deadlines, resolving all these disputes that people might have, having to manage sort of, having to just have a sort of quality control thing where you have to ensure that there's a standard of sort of what you output in terms of content, in terms of what you say, what you do, having to reprimand people, for example, if they do something bad. That's something you're not used to. I have a lot of siblings. I'm the oldest in my family, so I'm used to sort of, I guess, taking care of my siblings, but it's not the same as people your own age and having to take that role. And I guess adapting to research as well. So the medical, when you learn medicine, a lot of it is about understanding and applying what you learn. But with medical research, it's like understanding the real world. Right, it's not about just pre-written lectures that you already know, okay, this makes sense. When you're in doing medical research, something can make no sense at all, and you just have to try and either make sense of it or obviously ask for help from your superiors. So getting used to that sort of environment is new, but I think I enjoy that environment the most. So I mentioned about last summer where I went on the summer school. That was really a huge challenge because basically, obviously, I applied to do it and the medical school sent me there. But also all of the other students in the other medical schools globally also applied and the medical school sent them there. So you have this sort of handful group of people, hyper motivated, hyper active people. And we were getting through we would have maybe a lecture on machine learning, for example. And it would be like maybe six lectures in one, with like mathematics involved, and we'll have like a night or two to learn it, do the questions and then discuss it. And I was like, wow. And everybody would be doing it. And I remember speaking to the guy who organized it. He said like, yeah, this is how they teach in places like Stanford and Harvard. And I was just like, wow. I was like, yeah. So getting used to that was good. But it was good for me as well, because as I said before, it helped me understand sort of the standard at which things work on a global level and the standard and the speed at which you have to be able to compete if you want to start. If you just want to work at a global level, I guess, obviously you have experience with that, so you must understand. But especially like the bigger, like Canada, the students that came from Canada and America and the students from China and Hong Kong, for example, they were like, some of them were even younger than us and they were very, very well informed. And I was like, how did you learn this? Like,
gosh,
Yes, and I was just like, wow. But yeah, I think it's a lot of things to get used to. And then obviously starting clinicals. So the medical school is split into preclinical and the clinical stage. And the preclinical stage is basically learning, I guess, mainly biochemistry plus a lot of extra things. And it's just, I guess, it's very, very similar to your A-levels in terms of learning just strict academic stuff. When it comes to the clinical stage, you're doing a job, basically. And you're seeing patients face to face. You're integrating all of this knowledge to come with diagnosis, management plan, learning how to counsel patients, learning what is a good test, what is not a bad test, how to deal with difficult conversations. And I think that's just a dimension that it's the skills that you might have picked up on growing up, but having to do it at a professional level and at clinical standard is something you have to adapt to as well. So all of those things, they've helped me develop into the man that I am now. It has been challenges, and I'm happy to say that I have overcome them and I have learned from them. But I do remember how difficult it was at that stage, seeing it for the first time, sitting down for the first time, having to sort of make sense of it for the first time. I'm sure a lot of medical students would agree.
Definitely. I remember I had to go to hospital for a blood test, and I absolutely hate injections, anything like that. Mm-hmm. And the poor medical student who was trying to take my blood, I don't know if I should have been so honest about the fact that I found the whole thing nerve-wracking, but so nervous. And it seemed to just make it worse when I told her that I didn't like, and she was actually shaking, Habib, as she was trying to. So I really felt for her, but I thought, maybe I shouldn't have told her. I don't know.
It's scary. I think taking blood is probably the most scary thing you can do, because once you get over it, it's fine. But I guess that's the first time you're actually doing a sort of invasive procedure. And you're so scared. And it's just, taking blood is probably like as low risk as it can get, basically, as long as you don't do anything silly with the needle. But that first time, just like, what if I do something wrong? Like, you're kind of scared that you'll do something that'll just create a huge commotion. But it's not even that. I think the worst thing you can get is basically miss the vein, really. But yeah, it's terrifying the first time.
Well, it's just been absolutely wonderful talking to you, Habib, honestly. I love the humor that you bring into this as well. You know, it's been wonderful. I really have got a sense of your personality through this conversation. So thank you very, very much. And no, as always, wishing you every success as you go forward. Very proud of all you've achieved so far, and very excited to see what you do in the future.
Yeah, we'll see. I'm also excited, but we'll see what happens. Thank you.
And thank you to our lovely listeners for so faithfully following us and just being incredible, you know, with the feedback and support and encouragement. We would be nothing without our audience. So thank you very much. And I look forward very much to my next conversation with another truly inspiring leader, just like Habib. Thank you very much, everyone. And goodbye.